Welcome to the thrilling world of Security Squawk, where we explore cybersecurity. Guiding you through online threats, we'll aid you in understanding safety protocols and trends. Meet our gurus, Brian from ExactIT, Reginald from ArcSolvers, and Randy from TechRescue. Together, we'll delve into current events and hot cybersecurity topics, helping you comprehend their impact. Stay informed, stay secure. Security Squawk, the business of cybersecurity. Buckle up, let's dive in.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to another edition of the Cybersecurity, Security Squawk podcast. I am your co-host, Brian, here with Andre and Randy. We have a tight timeline this week, so we had to get the show in on Monday. And we have a tight timeline for Andre. So we're just going to get right into it to just get Andre's thought real quick on what we're about to talk to today, and then he's going to depart us pretty quickly. But we're going to talk about, mainly on today's show, this whole Microsoft web, so to speak, that Microsoft has created with, you know, the popularity of their M365 platform, the rapid adoption of that platform in the enterprise and in government, and especially our federal government, and the challenges that that presents to these entities as these products become more popular, not only with people using them, but with cyber criminals attacking them. And unfortunately, in the last 6 months or so, guys, we've had multiple federal agencies who've had issues around Microsoft 365. So we're going to dive into that and talk about that a little bit today and kind of give people a heads up that, yeah, Microsoft's great and everything, but you have to be aware that, you know, out of the box, this stuff is not secure. There are certain things you have to have in place. We're going to talk about what they are today. But really, at a bigger scale, what this means to you as an American and how it implicates or makes it more complex for national security. So let's talk about it. Andre, you were bringing something up in the green room, and I want to kind of run it to you real quick. It's like you were kind of bringing up the idea, or you were asking the question of, like, where was all this before M365? Because it seems like there's a huge spotlight on M365 around this whole government federal agencies being hacked, and, you know, Russians and Chinese basically sitting in our government's emails for a very long time. So before we get into, like, M365 and what's happening today, where did this all start and how did we get here?
Well, a long time ago, maybe 10 years ago, before Microsoft 365 was famous, and, you know, your emails would be hosted locally. It would be in some type of data center, and you would have, you know, administrators logging in and managing the emails. And as things got more efficient and more cloud-based, everything went to the cloud. But it was always thought that you would purchase the product. Oops, that was my hand. You would always purchase the product from Microsoft, and then you would have engineers that would just test the systems and make sure that from the point of when an email is sent out to us coming in, that company would be responsible. But now with 365, there's a lot of dependency of kind of like a set it and forget it, where it's like, okay, all right, Microsoft, I trust that their engineers are going to do it, and I'll just make sure I do my part by turning on two-factor authentication, making sure that, you know, we train our employees for phishing. But as we're seeing in these in this article and how I was just talking about in the last few years, there's been a lot of Microsoft mess-ups when it comes to errors that they've made, or just general vulnerabilities that you would be surprised on the enterprise level when they're protecting, you know, government agencies that you know, these countries are getting in and these bad actors are getting in. So just kind of, you know, that discussion, I'll leave it there as I have to sign off, is, you know, what are we going to do? Because it's a single point of failure. And if Microsoft goes down, it's something that, you know, the government's going to blame it on Microsoft. And that really shouldn't be the case. The government should have that full control to be able to use Microsoft as a tool, but at the same time, be able to have extra layers of protection that maybe you and I don't have as far as administrative access to make sure that Microsoft is doing what they're saying they're doing.
Interesting. You're really going to leave us after saying something like that?
Yes, so, I'll watch the replay. Thank you, guys.
Can I ask one follow-up question before we go? Before you go. All right, so are you saying that you're in favor of government having more access, or are you in favor of... I guess I look at it from a different angle. I look at it as like the government's kind of responsible for some of these things. Like just like we tell businesses, they're responsible for like the redundancy of their email. You know, their email might be in my M365, but they're responsible for the redundancy of it. So I guess, are you saying that Microsoft needs to be audited more, or does Microsoft need to be more upfront about what the government, meaning the customer, what their responsibilities are in this game?
I'm going to say they need to be audited more, and I would hope that the government has even more access than us MSPs would have in order to see if there is any type of vulnerability that they should know about that maybe Microsoft is not catching. For their tenant
only. At the end of the day, we're not necessarily talking about Microsoft M365 having vulnerabilities that are being exploited. We're talking about government entities using the M365 platform. And this is no different. You and I talk about this all the time, Andre. This is no different in private industry. They just buy these things and don't protect them well enough. And then they end up getting breached. You know, a hacker gets into the email and starts doing things. And that's what's happening with our government, except it appears, based on these articles that we have read, the four that I've read today on this, are basically all saying that the government, like the people, like these accounts that are being compromised, they have no clue that somebody's even in there reading their emails. And that's... to me, like, who's responsible for that? Who's responsible? Is Microsoft responsible for telling you that, hey, somebody could be in your email that might not be you? Or is that you to go find, you know, a way to figure that out? Right? I think that's a big ask, right? To ask a customer to go figure that out.
I would say, a year ago, I would say it's up to the customer 100%. But see, Andre, but times are changing so much that, and legislation is following up, and some of the last conversations coming out of Capitol Hill involved putting these companies in charge of their own security. And so, you know, back in the day, here's your operating system and your computer, you know, go try to make it secure if you can. Where now they're saying, you do that and you need to be responsible for that product that you deliver to the customer. So I think it's almost like a whatever answer we give, I think we're very quickly going to be in a place where the answer is yes, no matter what. Microsoft will be responsible for securing and locking down their own product.
And I think that's where this needs to go. Because at the end of the day, you know, we're protecting companies from the flaws in these products that criminals are taking advantage of. Fair statement, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if these flaws didn't exist, we wouldn't have much of a market for our cybersecurity services. Yeah, that would be another way to look at it, right? I've been for over 5 years. I've been on my soapbox kind of telling the country that, similar to how we have electronics that have that kind of little badge on it for UL listed, meaning like if you plug this into the wall, you're not going to blow your house up or get electrocuted. That's essentially what that thing means to you as a consumer. Software is going to have to go in that direction. It's going to basically say that, like, they wrote this to a certain standard. Now, I know we're not going to get there 100% because it's just not going to, it's not feasible. There's things that, and vulnerabilities that have yet to be discovered. But when they are discovered, you know, is it the responsibility of Microsoft to make sure that that vulnerability goes away and products are no longer exploitable? Or is it, again, does it go back to the customer? Right now, the ecosystem that's been built, it goes on to the customer. Because, yes, we push updates to your system, but it's on you to make sure that they get them done. Right?
Well, you have to do that because you never know when an update is going to potentially interact with the driver or potentially break things. So you've got that. So maybe they're going to have to become more like a phone. You know, a phone doesn't have drivers. I mean, they might. It does. I mean, on the inside, already built in. But what I'm saying is, like, you're not adding stuff to it and changing things and this or that. It is a set environment. And so the phone manufacturers can put out the updates to this thing, you know, every quarter, every month, or whatever they're doing, without really fear of breaking a bunch of devices. Microsoft might have to start doing that. And then I don't know, Brian, it's almost going to have to be a certificate on a like basic level, but then every single business has certain nuances. I mean, it's so complex, and every single business has certain nuances that you know, Microsoft can't tweak for. And, you know, they could probably learn a lot from Google and Google Workspace, which is not 100% secure, but it has a ton of security out of the box that kind of applies to all businesses, and no one really ever starts using it. And then, you know, wonders where stuff went, like emails and things like that. It has a really good baseline. Microsoft needs to do that, where they have a really good baseline that everybody can use, but you're still going to have to be tweaking for each business to take it to the next level and really go from what I call 80% to 100% or 99%.
So let's turn the conversation a little bit to the whole, like what's going on here? Like, let's kind of talk about and dig in. Like, we have multiple reports. So if we go back to what's actually happening here, and I kind of alluded to it and mentioned, we have Russians and we have Chinese. We have separate groups, both government-backed and private hackers in both countries that have basically just made it a priority for them to get into the email accounts of government workers in this country. And it's going on to the level of where it's starting to get the attention of media. It's starting to get the attention of CISA, of like how bad this really is and how clueless our federal government is that these cyber criminals are doing what they're doing. So I'm kind of sharing this from the Kiev Post, but this is just one article, one group that I happen to pick from. Wired Magazine has featured this. CNN has talked about it. And a lot of these different sites that I'm looking at are talking about Russians and they're talking about Chinese. And these are two different groups and two different things. Don't think these are one and the same or these are similar or related. They're not. So let's dive into that and let's talk about this a little bit. Implications does this have when these guys are getting into government officials' emails?
So it has a lot. And the first thing pops in my mind is, well, we just need to maybe get together as a bunch of countries, maybe the UN, and sign a cybersecurity hacking, you know, treaty of some kind and saying that this is an act of war. But then if you start thinking about it, the U.S. government and all the different three-letter agencies have been hacking other people around the world, you know, as long as there's been computers. I mean, we know that from, you know, what certain people have leaked, you know, when they left one of the agencies or this or that. We just know that it has been a form of espionage. And I don't know if hack's the right word, but it's been a form of spying going back 25, 30 plus years easy. So all that said, can we really go to Russia and say, hey, Russia, let's have a treaty. Cybersecurity, espionage, you know, cyber espionage is now considered an act of war. You know, oh, wait, we're already doing that to you, you know, or China or whatever. So I think this conversation's already been had. That's why no one, who out there is saying that? Who out there is saying it's an act of war, you know, which it kind of really is. If you think about it, I don't know. What are your thoughts?
I don't think you're wrong. I mean, I think that that's the geopolitical kind of cat and mouse game that our government plays with other governments when it comes to this stuff. Everybody's doing it. It's just how you're doing it, right? You know, we're not going to sit here and deny that other governments don't do the same thing that our government, or especially our military, does in terms of intelligence gathering type activities when it comes to hacking. We definitely do that. But if people understood the extent to which we do that versus other countries, then, right, you know, that you can start to make the argument that you kind of started to make, which is, you know, we'll turn, you know, a blind eye to what you've been doing, and we won't make a big deal about what you've been doing if you don't make a big deal about, like, say, ransomware or business email compromise. So, you know, the bigger question, I mean, I think what you're saying is definitely in play here. But in terms of, you know, let's just put it together this way. Like, we know at one point in time, there was a political candidate who had an email server, right, that was in a basement somewhere where he was putting government classified information on that private email server, right? And that's a huge no-no, mm-hmm, right? So what's the point of having a classification system when you're giving people free access to an email system like this? That's my thing, right? We're going to make a big deal about, say, the Hillary Clinton email server and say what a huge threat that is to national security. But at the same time, we basically are doing very little to secure the email accounts that more than likely probably have some level of classified information in them.
Right.
I mean, I know people are going to be like, well, that's an unclassified system or blah, 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 blah. Yeah, but we know that stuff gets into that system. Let's be real here about what goes on inside of government officials' emails. I'm sure there's official business, and I'm sure there's classified information shared over email, unencrypted, all the time.
And even if it's not classified, it's still information that can be collated by a ChatGPT/BadGPT or whatever you want to call it, and then used for targeted attacks with malware to open back doors and things like that. So it's not like, even if you're in some random account and there's nothing classified, you can still use what you get to open the next door, which can get you classified information.
Because, and this is such an interesting story to me, because we're going to see the behemoth of Microsoft go up against the behemoth of the United States of America. And what I mean is sure, Microsoft spends probably millions upon millions of dollars a year making sure that legislation doesn't get too strong against software companies, because they have a vested interest in producing software quickly. And when you're talking about the things that Randy and I are talking about on the show today, it's going to slow down their ability to do things and it's going to lengthen out their process, because you've got to figure if they're going to do this right, there's going to be some kind of auditing process built into, you know, like software development, you know, before it's allowed to be sold. And that's just going to slow things down tremendously. You know, think about when your house is being built. There's auditors that come through from the government that figure out if your contractor and your builder are doing things by code, or are they doing things the right way. This is going to be the same thing. Government officials are going to come in, they're going to evaluate how they're building the software, and they're going to decide whether it's good enough or not from a security standpoint. And then they won't be able to sell that to the public until it gets approved, right? Mm-hmm. So they have the approval to do it. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out, because Microsoft's going to continue to spend millions of dollars lobbying lawmakers not to write these laws and make these things the law of the land. But at the same time, because they're not doing this, their own email is getting hacked. And I'll say this to you, Randy. I mean, one thing that I know about our government and our elected officials, that once things start impacting them is once they start to take action.
Right.
Right. So it's not going to take too many of these breaches, or maybe one big event that they can kind of connect the dots back to an email breach, where this is going to become a serious problem for Microsoft, Google, and all the big tech giants, because the shot has already been fired across the bow in Biden's cybersecurity strategy that he laid out. And one of those pillars was to hold these big tech giants more accountable for their
part. Yeah, that's what part, I was referring to.
Right, their part in what we're doing here. So what do you think is going to happen? You know, I just kind of laid it out. Like, I say good luck to the tech giants, because like I said, when it comes to our own government being impacted versus maybe smaller big businesses, I think it's handled differently, and we'll see. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, I mean, this will be really interesting. I don't think they're going to throw Microsoft out. I think that's a really good point you made, though, that Microsoft does lobby quite a bit. But at the same time, I mean, we just had CISA like last month have like unpatched servers that were hacked. Yeah. So it's not like they're squeaky clean. I mean,
at the same time, this goes back to that whole point, though, right? CISA doesn't want to have to be, and no business, really, at the end of the day, if you think about this logically, right? No business who purchases a product like Avanti should, after they purchase it, have to worry about securing it or protecting it from being hacked, right? So now you've just thrust this organization into a situation where they have to deal with a problem, right? And I think like that whole thing that it's been going on for me, you know, I guess I would say vulnerability management patching has been prevalent for 5-7 years now, and it's been going strong. It's been getting more and more popular with businesses, and I think the more businesses look around and say, why are we doing, right? We're like, why are we the ones responsible for this? So I think in the CISA case, they're going to look at Avanti in the same way we're looking at Microsoft here and say, you need to do a better job of putting better software out so we don't have to ever deal with this problem in this manner.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. And I think we will eventually be there, you know, maybe potentially within a year.
Oh, no, it's going to take.
If not, well, you know,
it's going to take decades to get to where we're talking about, because again, you're going to be fighting companies who are going to lobby. And if you don't, well, think government officials are going to take every steak dinner coming to them.
Yeah. I'm not saying how long we get to where, let's say they said today, okay, right, starting now, you have to keep all your stuff updated. You're like, Avanti's now responsible for all Avanti things. I'm saying like, it would be at least a year before that could be put into action, if not five. I'm saying a year, just because now with maybe ChatGPT, they could maybe figure out some things faster than they would have before, or, you know, with other forms of AI, but still, I just don't think it's something we can just snap our fingers and say, there's just so many little nuances, man. Like, what if Avanti updates and it breaks a server because the server is running Sage 100, and normally Sage 100 works, but in this particular case, they're also using, you know, let's just throw out QuickBooks, which is not a thing, but let's say they're using QuickBooks. So Sage had to react to how it's on there because of QuickBooks, and because of how Sage is on there, it breaks Avanti being updated to the very next thing. I mean, those are the kind of complexities we deal with, which is why patching's been left in the hands of IT. Like they have it. If there's a vulnerability, there's a patch available, but they don't just auto push a lot of these things because of those little complications. That's what I'm saying. That's where it's going to get a little more. It's where it's going to be hard to just roll it out and say it and make it happen. I think it's going to be a very difficult undertaking.
It's going to be a very difficult undertaking, but so is flying to the moon. I mean, at the end of the day, we can do this better. I mean, that's where I'm at with this.
You're right.
I think that incidents like this are going to shape the relationship of the large technology vendors, partners out there, and these government challenges. I think the government challenges, in a way, this is not going to sound good that I'm going to say this, but I'm glad that the government is such a target for cyber criminals, because at least they're fighting the good fight firsthand, and they're not looking at this right. Far, right?
It goes back to what you said. If it affects them, there's going to be action quicker.
Right. If it was just, you know, affecting hospitals and schools and, you know, some small businesses here and there, I don't think, you know, it gets the attention that it's going to get here. But it'll be interesting to see where this goes, because, you know, the first 5 to 7 years of cybersecurity, so to speak, it's been put in the hands of us, the IT people. And yeah, we not only have to figure out how to secure it, but we also have to make sure it doesn't break in the process, which is a huge undertaking. And there's a lot of things that can change in terms of standardization and just process control in terms of the software developers that can really improve this stuff a lot. So, you know, companies can get back to innovating and building technology that innovates versus building technology that protects data, right? Every mm-hmm. minute we spend protecting data and spending on cybersecurity is less we can spend on innovation.
Right.
So, and that's a big deal if you really think about it. Right. It's opportunity cost, because you're trying to play defense,
mm-hmm.
Which prevents you sometimes from playing as, you know, the offense you want to play.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else out of this, Randy, that caught your eye
the article that you have up right now?
Yeah.
So this is the same group that was behind the SolarWinds hack.
Yeah.
And the SolarWinds hack is like the most ingenious and the most simplest attack at the same time. You do a targeted phishing attack on developers for specific software. You get into their systems. You wait till they go up and go to the bathroom. You add a little, you know, this much code as a backdoor. They publish that day's changes. The EXE or MSI, which is the installer, gets updated, and boom, it gets rolled out on thousands of machines around the world. Ingenious, but simple at the same time. And the way it says in this article, I'd love to, you know, not on another show, but on my own time, I think, deep dive into how they were able to get into these accounts. But according to this article, it was a password spraying account.
Yeah.
I mean, so once again, that's like that. It's like that hacker that was working out of his parents' basement, literally in London, who was in charge of a worldwide group that was really making moves. They were just doing things like this. Is that really all these guys are doing? It was a password spraying account, and they're getting into accounts that are, you know, that don't have MFA? Is that what they're doing? I mean, so that's a big question to ask.
I mean, that's the crux of the whole argument between the government and Microsoft. Microsoft's basically saying, yeah, we're providing you the platform, but you have to make sure you're using it in a secure way. We can't protect you from everything. You're using, you know, password 1234, and that's your password. And you disabled MFA because, you know, we basically force you to use it now, and you those are the things that Microsoft argues that, like, at the end of the day, it's impossible for us to be held responsible for this. Because, you know, at the same time, they have to sell a product that people want to use. And if you start putting up these roadblocks and users don't like them, users won't use their products.
So, you know, and on one respect, I'm kind of going to kind of take the side of Microsoft here because, you know, okay, so what when they talk about suspicious logins, they look and they see, well, you know, Randy just logged in San Marcos, Texas, and oh, wait, now he's logged in, you know, in Kiev. Well, what if Randy's using I'm hypothetical me, but, you know, what if I'm using a VPN? You know, should they lock it out? Should they block? So that's typically left to the IT company. So we have people in companies all the time, you know, they don't let us know. They forget to let us know they're going to be in Colombia, right? And so we get a notification that the CEO logged in Colombia. Apparently they were in airplane mode from all the way from Texas all the way to Colombia. We've got to know, are they really in Colombia or not? And so with the suspicious login, it's really hard. It's really hard to be able to tell. I mean, there's some things we could do. We could say, hey, if no one's ever logged into an account after 60 days and it's not an admin, password automatically gets reset. Microsoft will automatically end all logins. I mean, if we did something like that and we knew in advance that that's what we're looking at, then us as IT, we could adjust to that change, which that would probably be a pretty good change. They could also say all accounts, you know, other than an admin account, all accounts have to have MFA. The reason I say other than admin is a lot of times people will have a break fix or break glass account. It's only used in emergencies. It doesn't have MFA or any conditions on it in case you get locked out of everywhere. But something like that, knowing that all users would have to have MFA turned on to be able to log in. If they said that out of the box, then IT could adjust. And we would need a little bit of, heads up. All IT ought to be doing that anyway. But obviously we found out in this case, the government doesn't require it on a lot of their accounts because the Russians were using, this Russian group was using a password spray attack. They're just trying all the passwords that they know, you know, off the dark web or whatever. So it's going to have to be a both and. There are things that they can do. You know, we have certain regulatory compliances for clients. And we went in recently on two clients, found that they had two new clients found that they had a bunch of personally identifiable information, PII, which in both cases is under compliance regulations. And we just told them, we're going to go in once a week. We're going to clean all temp files off your computer except for cookies, because we found PDFs that you're just opening up in your browser that are sticking on your machine. And even though your machine is encrypted, we don't like all that information sitting there. And we also told them, we found downloads going back like years. And we're like, we're going to delete all your downloads that are over older than like 30 days. It's not perfect. It's better than what you were doing, and it puts you more in line with your compliance. And we had to give them a heads up. That's all I'm trying to say.
The moral of the story is you can't buy this stuff and just use it.
Right.
And think you're secure.
Right.
So many examples that we can give.
Yes.
Of people using technology and just like, same thing with us. We just had a prospect we were talking to the other day. They're like, we don't keep PII anywhere, but here in this like two places.
Yep.
We found PII everywhere. I mean, and it's like same stuff. Temp locations, recycle bin, like all the places where people don't realize files get stored and saved on a computer. They don't realize that that device, that hard drive, that laptop now contains PII when they think it's over here. We see it all the time in healthcare too. And it's the same thing with the government. It's like the same example I used earlier when I said, like, government classified information is probably in this email. That's why they just go in and sit there and read it and don't do anything else. Like, they don't send out spam. They don't try to use the account in any nefarious way. They're just getting access to hundreds, if not thousands, of accounts and doing as much reconnaissance as they can. That's it. Yeah. All right, man, I got to go. Thanks so much for helping me out on the show.
Thanks for helping me out.
Yeah. Good one. And please remember, share the show, like and subscribe where you can. Helps other people find this content and helps us with the show and helps support us and keep us pumping out this content. Appreciate all you supporters out there. We'll see everyone next week. Take care.
Yeah, everybody.